had those concerns. But you might want to talk a little bit about, because we had a little kind of a set to there, and you were under a lot of stress. You're trying to get ready to go for, you're trying to get prepared to go to Vladivostok, if you remember that,
right,
that council meeting. And as the council meeting began, you kind of called me over and said, you know, I'm a little concerned about some of the language. And what it, and I've got a, do you recall?
No, I don't recall.
I have a pretty good idea as to why that happened. But let me see if I can refresh your memory.
Okay.
We had received a memo from Dan Vopel, which summarized the key points of the final version that we had at the dais. And this was under second reading. And in that, and I've got it in my packet. And in there, Vopel had misinterpreted a section that I had written in, or Skip and I had written in, about reserving places on the board for non-residents.
Oh,
that.
Yes.
And
yes.
Then in there, he used the word, and it can further restrict, rather than, the intent wasn't to restrict, but he used the word, and the bylaws can further restrict membership.
That's right. That's right.
And right before that meeting started, someone from, I think, the poor of the chamber came up and said, you know, we're really distressed about this. And a lot of things were going on. That was a last-minute, that language went in just before the council. In fact, we may have met that Monday to put that language in. And that was a last-minute, that was in the substitute that was enforced. The person from the poor was concerned about it. Some people from the chamber were concerned about it. I explained to them, I said, Vopel's interpretation is incorrect. What that means, in essence, is that specific positions can be made available for those stakeholders if there is a feeling that should be. That makes it different. And then you were, apparently they were talking to you too, because you seemed to be nonplussed.
Well, I remember very vividly now that language that seemed to give the board the right to close the door almost on those positions, or limit them down to one or two positions on a board of however many. And that did disturb me. Mm-hmm. It kind of seemed to be the reverse of the direction we had taken in opening the door to allow individuals to have access to the board. How did we resolve that?
Well,
and it may have been just a misinterpretation of the language.
Well, part of the way we resolved that, because you left early because you were taking off your trip, and I think there was a lot of things going through your head at the time, and the context is explains, you know, how people respond to things, obviously, and that includes me and everybody else, but. The issue, that particular meeting went on till wee hours, and at the end, as a part of the record, and I even, if you want to look at the tape, I've looked at it, I mentioned, I said, now Council Member Miller and I had conversation, and he expressed some concerns about what this meant, and then I read this from the memo, and I said, that's a misinterpretation of the intent. And then I said that there's another provision within the ordinance that allows the city council to review these bylaws and to approve them. And then I said, if there's anything in there in the bylaws that specifically restricts membership on the board, then we as a council can take action to address that issue. And so I wanted to make sure all that was on the record so that people understood clearly what we meant. Now, by that time, of course, it was first reading, and we'd had our public hearing, and that was the one change.
So we obviously resolved it, because I don't remember being concerned with it at the end.
Yeah. Well, that was, as I say, that was the one situation, and again, at the time, I thought it was a little baffled by. Well, it wasn't really. I mean, the meeting, and you had a situation where, and as you remember, you had Mike Lynn and you had Karen, and everything was volatile to begin with. And any kind of discussion that was, you know, any way heated, or if there was a debate or what have you, you know, you always feared, and I feared, and I think you probably felt the same way, that Karen or Mike Lynn would come unglued.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And Michaelin was sitting there watching what was going on in the discussion, and the pressure builds, and then Karen comes in and she said, what's going on, and the pressure continues to build.
Oh yes. Oh yes. Yeah.
That's what happened on it. Now, one of the things that I think you mentioned on that meeting where you left, that was, and as I understand, we had a conversation afterwards. It was essentially feeling on your part that you had to leave the next day for Vladivostok.
I was about a half hour past the deadline I gave myself, where I had to get. I had a couple of business items that had to be completed, and I had to get home and pack. I hadn't even packed at that point.
Because I think you left. I think you were either the Wednesday or Thursday the following. Maybe the next day.
Well, I think it was the next day.
Yeah, because then the following.
Because I remember coming back, and everybody thought I had stormed off the dais.
Yeah.
When I had gotten up to go to the bathroom and realized what time it was, and.
Well, because you didn't, you know, it was interesting because I looked at the tape. You didn't look like you were. You didn't slam anything down and storm off.
I went out to the bathroom.
Yeah.
And realized what time it was. You know how you get into those debates and lose all track of time.
Yeah. Also that night, if you recall, and I looked at the tape, that was the night the Gig Harbor people were there. See, that was Urban Growth, and that place was packed.
Yeah.
And I think anyone looking out at the crowd had to realize there'd be about an hour or 2 hours of public hearing before we got, because that was right on the, because that right as soon as we finished it was the Invesco issue. As soon as that issue was finished, then we moved right into this first read. It wasn't a hearing, first reading neighborhood council. This was the urban growth the growth management thing. See, that was
which I wasn't there for that.
Yeah. And I think looking back, if I were in your shoes, and I was taking off of Vladivostok and figured I had to get some business done, looking at that chambers, you knew that anyone. Well, we all knew that was going to last about an hour and a half. And that's when we were compared.
I remember really clearly. I got up and went to the bathroom, and realized when I was in there what time it was. So I came back and tried to, kind of flag to Karen, and she was tied up doing something or listening to somebody. So I headed out.
Yeah.
Kind of surprised me.
That was a wild, crazy meeting because Karen was in rare form then. So was Mike Lind. And it just instigated the I've never seen anything quite like it. And that was when a woman got up and yelled out the top of her head, stood up first time. And she said, I've never been more insulted in my life, and stormed out of the meeting. That's when we were compared to Saddam Hussein. Oh, it was. And Karen kept saying, you got to behave yourself. And of course, she was misbehaving.
Yeah. Well, I'm sorry I missed it.
Tape is over there if you want to see the circus. Is there anything else that you can think of that you obviously had concerns, you expressed those concerns, you felt that most of what you wanted in the ordinance, some of the more jurisdictional aspects that were of concern to Barker, whether we could even require or set up a body to give them that authority was in question legally. Mm-hmm. Barker's concern, he thought it was a crazy idea. His concern was that we were giving these groups the information to turn around and sue us, because they were independent bodies, and we're giving them jurisdictional authority to review and be a part of a procedure laid out by state law.
Right.
Which was very questionable.
Well, I think, as I recall, I had four main concerns, all of which got addressed, and I think in the end result, we came out with an outstanding compromise. One was the voice of youth in the process, and we didn't close the door. We originally had language that restricted membership to above 18, and we opened that up to where membership could be
the high school kids.
High school kids.
Yeah, 16 years.
Right. Membership on the board, so that we ensured that we weren't getting a restricted voice out of the neighborhoods, but we were getting the voice of everyone, that there was an opportunity for the mixing of business owners and residents in that voice. I'm kind of going in reverse order. I think the third issue was the involvement of the neighborhood councils in the land use process and the layering effect of having to require a time frame for individuals wanting anything from a from a building permit or a variance to a rezone to go through the step of getting kind of the permission and a concurrence out of the neighborhood councils. And that was the concern that I think Bill shared, Barker shared, of handing off some of our legal responsibilities to a separate unelected body. And I think what we structured was a much better process that clearly involves the neighborhood councils and draws their input into the process along with everyone else's. And then the fourth, and probably the one that disturbed me the most in the first proposal, seemed to be kind of a wall we were building where there was almost an expectation that citizens' concerns and complaints would go to the neighborhood councils first, and the neighborhood councils would then communicate those to us. And that dissolved fairly quickly as people understood. You've got to continue to maintain clear and direct access between the citizens and the elected body.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought that what we came out with was a very workable document.
Mm-hmm. So far.
Well, yeah. Seems to be working quite well. I had some doubts as to how well the communication links between the neighborhood councils and the community council would occur. Mm-hmm. And I really don't know that I have any knowledge as to how it actually came about, or how well it's working, I should say.
Yeah.
But I know I had concerns as to whether or not that was going to work as effectively as we had hoped.
One of the real beauties of that, I don't know if you were in that one meeting, we had the first meeting of community council, there were several of us sat in.
Yes.
One of the real things that impressed me, that it was kind of exciting, here we had in one room people from every part of the city.
Yep.
I mean, normally I'm in rooms with people from the North End or the South End or, you know, McKinley Hill, but, you know, there's someone from everywhere.
Yeah.
That was great. That was great.
You going to be around for a bit?
Yeah, I didn't hear. I just didn't give you your tape. I didn't know.
Don't disappear.
I won't.
To catch.
Yeah. Sure. Well, that was pretty damn exciting.
Yeah. Oh, I thought so.
I think the other thing that was kind of a breakthrough from what
You know what I liked the most about that meeting?
Which was?
Was everybody went around, and then it was like, council members were totally ignored.
Yeah.
I mean, it's like, we could have not been there for all they cared.
Right.
And I liked that.
Yeah.
I mean, that was the whole purpose of structuring the community council that would work independently.
Yeah. Well, some of them are working better than others, and I would like to, you know, your point's well taken too about this intent of involving youth, that we haven't made much of an effort there, but it seems to me that one thing that we could do is maybe strike up a relationship with some of the civics teachers at the high schools, and assign, if maybe they would assign or could assign, or maybe suggest to them that they could assign to some of their students sitting in these council meetings, participating in these council meetings, maybe even running, like they have to be 18 to run for board members, but participating in the election of board members.
Ex officio positions on the board.
Yeah, just sitting in and,
positions for youths, as we do with some of our committees.
Yeah.
I think would be tremendous. I think we need that, because a lot of the problems we face as crime continues to be a problem is involving our youths in a community where they believe that it's important to take care of their neighborhoods. It's important to look out and better their neighborhoods.
Yeah.
And if we don't involve them, that's not going to happen.
Yeah. That is something we have not yet, something we probably could work through the school district with. We haven't really yet developed that. I know that Mr. Haggerty in the library now, is my understanding, he's assigning staff to, which I find somewhat ironic, to the neighborhood council meetings, which is great. The park district is looking at it, and I think, hey, the next step should be the school district involving young people. It's a great idea.
Sure. That's real good.
Okay. Very good. What do we have on our agenda, buddy?
As well as causing the accident involving falling off a lathe while adjusting the machine for a job was directly related to a state of intoxication. Although this is a clear violation of the rules of the company, management should have recognized the danger of an alcoholic in these situations and attempted to take actions to rehabilitate or deal with the employee and the problem at that point. Furthermore, an analysis of Jones' interpersonal relations with both management and the accuser, Jim Phelps, demonstrate that management attempted and finally succeeded in discharging the grievant at all costs. The facts of the case surrounding the Jim Phelps sworn statement shows that there was a dire animosity between Jones and Phillips. The statement so much as states, "I, being Jim Phelps, do not like him," being Jones. Aside from this blatant malice on his part, no other information can be reliably extracted from this statement. By his own admittance, the only witness of the alleged act of threatening of a fellow employee had extreme malice toward Robert Jones. The grievance was clearly filed with the intent to terminate Jones because immediately following this grievance, the employee, Jim Phelps, quit. So he couldn't have had any other reason but to strike back at Jones. You cannot use one employee's word against another to fire someone. Since there were no other witnesses involved in this case, it is basically my word against yours, and you really cannot base a termination on such an event if there's no other proof. Furthermore, if he was discharged for this reason, there were two people involved in this threatening. Both Robert Jones and a Richard Ball, another employee, jointly threatened Jim Phelps. If Jones was discharged for these reasons, why wasn't Richard Ball, or at least given a written warning? An analysis of the grievance committee meeting immediately following this act of threatening shows no indication that any disciplinary action was taken against Richard Ball, the other quote-unquote guilty participant. Repeatedly, company reports concerning Jones suggest that management, along with Phillips, has been trying to buffer their case against the accused with the end goal of termination. As an indication of this emotionalization of facts in a document that is supposed to be purely factual with no bias at all, in 1977, after the assault incident, Robert Clark, who as a coincidence states was the person who ended up firing him later in 1980, overemphasized the incident by writing in a document of fact that Jones, quote, struck Fred Cook heavily in his jaw, seriously, and causing profuse bleeding. There's an undeniable coincidence that the same manager that exaggerated the report in 1977 was the same individual that caused this unnecessary arbitration hearing. Another example of how management was trying to bolster their case is a comparison between the May 8th, 1980 disciplinary action report citing violation of threatening and causing disturbance, that sort of thing, and the resurrection of these violations, with the additional adding the addition of B4 and C3, shows that in 25 days later, when this was rehashed, shows that management's attempt to bolster their case, providing ample justification for future discharge. It seems clear that they didn't feel that they had ample justification for future discharge, so they added more things to pump up their case. Moreover, the company, in general, not taking a step back from this issue, professes a relationship with the union and its members as being harmonious. The facts contradict this erroneous claim through the large numbers of grievances filed by employees. This indicates a tension between union and management that management is either unknowledgeable of or deceptively misstating in this case. In addition, the company violated the basic tenets of due process here. Specifically, on April 4th, 1980, Robert Jones was given a first written warning by management for leaving work early. In the document, his disciplinary action, management stated that he violated company policy number D5, which, as we all know, is threatening, intimidating, coercing, or interfering with employees or supervisors at any time. In fact, he actually violated rule B1, which entails leaving the plant during working hours without permission. The severity between the disciplinary penalties of these two charges is drastic. One allows for discharge, the other allows for a mere 5-day suspension. Management clearly misinterpreted their own policy, thereby manipulating due process regarding Robert Jones. The next disciplinary action inflicted upon Jones on May 8, 1980, was a suspension with the intent to discharge, concerning management's claim that he disregarded rules D5, again, D6, and C2 by destroying company property under the influence of alcohol. Jones had not previously broken rule D5 or any of these other rules, so he should have received a written warning according to their own company policy. This would have allowed him to go the management to go on record about these infractions and allowed him to correct his behavior. There is a direct correlation involved in handling of the May 7th case related to due process and his ultimate discharge with this hearing. Due to the violation of due process, the employer cannot prove that what erroneously had happened. They cannot legally prove what didn't actually happen. Just cause is a doctrine that requires the accusing party to have sufficient proof that the employee was willfully at fault concerning the alleged misconduct. The facts of this case clearly show that for reasons of perceived precedent, his medical illness, the estranged personal relations between Jones and the selected employees, and finally, management's misuse of due process, the arbitrator should find for the grievant. As compensation for Robert Jones, he should be reinstated with regular straight-time back pay in accordance with Article 14, Section 19 of their own contract. Thank you.
Hold on, or boo.